Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. What is it like to be a citizen of one nation subsumed within a larger nation whose fundamental economic, social, political, and cultural goals are so often at odds? That is the central question oral historian Sarah Sinclair raised with the 12 Indigenous people who are featured in the new book, How We Go Home, Voices from Indigenous North America. It was created with Voice of Witness. They amplify unheard voices through their oral history book series. The first person stories are told by Indigenous people in the U.S. and Canada. They discuss their ongoing work to protect native land, revitalize culture and language, advocate for environmental justice, end the ongoing crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, and so much more. And they tell deeply, deeply personal stories. In the book, Sarah Sinclair writes, collectively, the narratives in this book drive home how long the attack on and erasure of Indigenous land has simultaneously been an attack on Indigenous people, their families, and nations. This is the foundational context from which each of the following narratives should be read. Sarah Sinclair is an oral historian, writer, and educator of Cree, Ojibwe, and settler descent. She is the editor of How We Go Home, Voices from Indigenous North America. Sarah Sinclair teaches in the Oral History Master's Program at Columbia University. Hi, Sarah. Thank you so much for this important book, and thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Suzanne Methot, a writer, editor, and educator of Nehi'o Heritage. Suzanne Methot is author of Legacy, Trauma, Story, and Indigenous Healing, and other educational books. Suzanne is curriculum specialist for How We Go Home, Voices from Indigenous North America. Hi, Suzanne. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Hi there. Thanks for having me as well.
Well, it's great to have both of you. I want to ask you both a general question to start off, because we cover Native issues probably more than most other non-Native stations. And what's so interesting right now is that there are so many more Native books coming out. Native Twitter has just been amazing, calling out, CNN, for example, when they put up when they were talking about various people who were voting for Biden. I believe it said Black, Asian,
something else,
right? Latino, and then something else for Natives. So on the one hand, you do have ongoing erasure. On the other hand, I've just never seen so many books. There are films coming out. People are really telling their own stories. So Sarah, what are your thoughts about that and where we are right now?
Yeah, I mean, that was such a motivating factor for me as well, that kind of in-between place that you're describing. You know, both Suzanne and I are from the other side of the northern United States border. I grew up in Toronto and went to pretty progressive elementary schools in that city. And yet the experience that I had with First Nations or Indigenous narratives as part of my educational experience was pretty slim, pretty spare. And so I was really conscious of the fact that I wasn't growing up with those stories as part of my own formal educational experience. And then also like as a, you know, as a learner into my university age as well, that they're just that those stories weren't, there weren't opportunities given to bring those stories into those spaces. So that was a part of a movement that I really wanted to be joining. And it does feel like a moment where that's changing, and something that I hope that the book itself, the narratives in the book, also really convey, that these are stories about people who can speak to a lot of intergenerational trauma, but they're also people who are really, really keenly aware of this moment as a moment to also bring forward intergenerational memory, that there is this opening now, both within Native communities themselves, recalling the past and bringing that collective memory and culture forward, but also more space being given in the national dialogue, both in the United States and in Canada, to start bringing some of these Indigenous stories into the forefront as well.
What about you, Suzanne? What would you add? How would you address that question?
Well, my experiences are exactly the same as Sarah's. So a big yes on that. Absolutely. And one thing I would add is that, you know, so often Indigenous peoples have been flavor of the month. Mm. You know, something happens and I hope it doesn't happen, but we saw this summer with the Black Lives Matter movements and even the Me Too movement and different things that have been happening. Work that's been going on for years, but it hits in the wider society at this moment in time, and things kind of happen and books are published, and then it kind of dissipates and disappears, because when that happens, we tend or have tended in the past not to have that systemic and structural change, right? So we've tended to be the flavor of the month. I'm seeing, however, that maybe at this point in history, things are going to be different, because I just sense that there are more, you know, institutions and organizations reaching out and saying, yes, we need to do this work inside our organization, and publishers reaching mm-hmm. out and not just waiting for the proposals to come from Indigenous writers, but actually reaching out and saying, how would you like to submit a page sample for this? Because we want to publish this book. So I feel like it's a little different of a vibe. So I'm hoping we're not just going to be flavor of the month. And I think I would end by saying that I have seen change, and I do want to acknowledge that. You know, when I started out as an activist in the 90s, you know, we were writing letters to our, you know, public broadcaster here in Canada, the CBC, and we were doing all of this work, and it was just so hard. Like, people weren't even using the right terminology. They were still calling us Indians, right? And now things are different. You know, media is not talking about us so much, or, you know, at least not all the time. They're talking with us, as you are, and have a long history of doing. But so it has changed, and I want to acknowledge that. But I just also want to put out this thought, too, that this better not be more flavor of the month stuff.
Sarah, what will it take to ensure that this is not flavor of the month stuff, especially as, at least here in the United States, there is a reckoning happening with the true history of this country, which is so rare, because mm-hmm. going back to the, you know, where we are right now, where we move forward, but then we go backward. Just hearing you both, I was reminded of a mini documentary that was played during the Democratic National Convention. John Meacham is a well-known historian in this country, and he did like a 4 or 5 minute little video about the history of this country. Natives were never mentioned. It's like they didn't even exist. And it hits me, because my, you know, grandmother's Poma, my grandfather's Paiute, but I wonder, does it hit other people, unless it becomes a hashtag on Twitter?
Yeah, you know, I mean, one of the things that I was thinking about as Suzanne was speaking is that I think one reason that we're seeing some of that structural change in Canada is because we had something called a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, mm-hmm. which I believe is now going to happen as well here. I believe that Deb Haaland has been pushing that forward. And that was a commission into the legacy of the what we call the Indian residential schools, and what you call the Indian boarding schools, the intergenerational legacy of that abuse that happened at those schools. And so what happened with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, it was essentially a large oral history project that traveled across Canada that gathered the testimonies of thousands of survivors of those schools. And then one of the results of that commission was a list of mandates that were to be implemented on a national, provincial, municipal, and tribal level. And one of the big pushes has been to make more room to force space for Indigenous, not just stories, but also ways of learning, ways of knowing throughout the educational experience for young Canadians, for all young Canadians. And of course, you know, that there's been the different provinces are having different, the provinces administer education in Canada. They're having different levels of success. But the fact that that was something that was prioritized on a national level is a pretty big change. And maybe that's something that will be coming here as well, as an outcome of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission forthcoming in the United States. That's something that I've been thinking a lot about, myself over the last couple months as we've been promoting the book, because people ask, you know, what can we do to change things? And I think so much about, you know, I've heard stories of collecting the stories for this book, young Native students going off to these, you know, esteemed universities and having to then educate their professors about how they're overlooking or leaving out, as you just said, the Native history that's foundational to this continent. And so how can that change? You know, how can we have the experience of raising new generations of people so that it isn't falling on the shoulders of Indigenous people to educate grown-ups when they encounter them in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and beyond, but instead, you know, we raise a new generation starting them on Indigenous stories. You know, I have a five-year-old son, so, you know, one thing that I try to do in my, you know, Brooklyn community is gift our young family friends stories from First Nations authors with the sort of hope that, you know, you start this reading young and then you grow with it. Mm-hmm. There are great series for older kids. Louise Erdrich has a Birch Bark House series. And then, you know, when you're in grade 7 and 8, you're already ready for a book like mine. So start that learning young so that, you know, it's not something that has to become a project later on to fill this huge hole in your consciousness.
Suzanne, what would you add? How can we ensure that beyond the media that really do focus on these issues, that these stories are told in the wider media and they don't just die out, you know, when Native American Heritage Month is over, for example?
Yeah. When the month is over, the day is over. Well, I mean, I would again echo what Sarah said around the importance of the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And I would hope that something like that, or even we've also had up here, you know, another sort of investigation into the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And they too released a report that had, you know, I don't know if they call them calls to action, but definitely, you know, mm-hmm. mandates for, you know, going forward with the kind of change that needs to happen. So if that could also happen in the US, and yes, I, part of the change that I mentioned, you know, when you asked the last question around, you know, what I've seen in the last 25 and 30 years, definitely a lot of that has happened in the education system. So that's one of the reasons why I went back as a 39-year-old so-called mature student. I'm not sure how mature I was, but, you know, and got a postgraduate degree in education and decided to leave behind my writing for a few years and the work that I had been doing in Indigenous organizations and that sort of thing to focus on education. Because as Sarah said, I felt like, you know, we had to do so much education with adults that I thought, no, we got to get these kids when they're young, right? We've got to start, you know, not teaching them what to think, obviously, that's not what educators do, but teaching them how to think and how to question resources around what voices are missing here. Mm-hmm. Whose voice does this prioritize, so that they can look at the Democratic speeches and immediately see, ah, Indigenous voices are missing. Or when they can look at that CNN poll and understand that, oh, well, what could the something else be? What's the other in this survey? And to do that work, you know, I just want to say that so many schools, not enough, unfortunately, there's lots of schools that aren't doing this, but there are many schools that are signing on in both Canada and the US and using, you know, Voice of Witness books and curriculum to really make sure that we create a new generation that absolutely knows the truth of what has happened in the Americas, so that there's no stories that are only from one viewpoint.
Right. And so it's also not just focused on the past. So it mm-hmm. also focuses on the contemporary stories that are told in this really incredible book. Again, it's called How We Go Home, Voices from Indigenous North America. And we're speaking with the editor of the book, Sarah Sinclair, an oral historian and a writer, and Suzanne Methot, who's a writer, an educator, and curriculum specialist for the book. If you have any questions or comments for Sarah or Suzanne, we'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to talk about what really has struck you when you think about the changes in terms of just telling the truth about the history of the U.S. and also what happens in Canada. Later in the show, I'd love to ask both of you just what you think about the changes really between the U.S. and Canada, and how it's so easy and so often the United States is called America, right? Instead of, there's North America, there's Central America and South America. It's just always called America, which when that's in our headline or something, I try to change it. But you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. I also just want to talk about COVID because, Sarah, you talk a little bit about this in the introduction. It's just so important to acknowledge how COVID has really affected Native communities. A number of people who speak their languages, sometimes the only ones, have passed. At one point, the Navajo Nation had the highest infection rate. And I think a lot of people, for some, it was the first time that they learned that 30% of Navajo families do not have access to running water. And so we talk about the big picture, the books, the documentaries, the history. But then when you drill down, something as fundamental as water in this wealthy country and 30% of Navajo families do not have access to it, that says a lot.
Yeah, and that's an issue on the other side of the border as well, and has been for a very, very, very long time. There are many communities, First Nations in Ontario in particular, that don't have access to clean water or have had mercury in their water for decades. And the government, you know, a number of governments have said that they're going to fix it and don't fix it. And yet they can, you know, dedicate millions and billions of dollars to building the pipelines that will move the oil, the crude oil from Alberta through this side of the border. It's pretty extraordinary the ways in which resources are dedicated and not dedicated. With respect to COVID, looking at the Navajo Nation, which I had the great joy of visiting as part of my work towards this project, although there isn't a narrative from the Navajo Nation, I did drive through the nation. And it's a huge and sprawling place. It's very rural. And the infrastructure has not kept up with the times. Obviously, there has not been enough money devoted to maintaining the infrastructure there. But in addition to that, you know, so many of the comorbidities that people speak about that is a result of the intergenerational trauma that you see in both First Nations communities and Native American communities, a lack of access to healthcare. Many people have to drive, I'm going to say, you know, hours to access healthcare from on the Navajo Nation. And they may already be living with pre-existing conditions. They're also more likely to be living in multi-generational homes. All of those things made them much more susceptible to this disease.
Mm-hmm. And also our high rates in the Indigenous community of diabetes and other diseases that came with colonization and capitalism. And we're not a part of our lives or our communities before, like at all. Of course, we know that folks with diabetes are at a higher risk of dying from COVID-19.
Right. Well, and that was also a theme in so many of the stories, Sarah, is just how young people today are still so affected by intergenerational trauma. I mean, some of the stories are just really, really hard to read. They're very intense, but very, very real. And in a country like the United States, you know, that prides itself in some ways on this individualist, pull yourself up kind of thing, I feel that a lot of people just don't understand how the past really still affects the future. Can you talk about that? Because it really came across in your book.
Sure. I mean, I think for me, when I think about intergenerational trauma, I mean, it's definitely present in all of the narratives, but I think a lot about Ashley Hemmer's who is from Fort Mojave, which is a nation that overlaps the Nevada, California, and Arizona borders. She speaks a lot about the intergenerational effect because she kind of tells her own story, as so many Indigenous people do, in the context of her extended family. So for her, when I went to go meet her, she very generously started our encounter with a drive. She picked me up at the Las Vegas airport and then drove me out to Fort Mojave the following day. She started the day by taking me to the place where the Mojave believe their spirits come to this lifetime, and then drove me around to show me the sort of the villages, as they call them. There's housing settlements, basically, where the Mojave live today. And then ended the day at the site where the Mojave believe their spirits leave to meet the creator, to be sort of judged on whether they lived a good life. And in the middle of all of that, she told me the story of her grandmother, her mother, and herself. And her grandmother, like, you know, many, many others, like my grandfather and like many of the narrators and in this book, her grandmother was a boarding school survivor. And so she was able to tell me really specifically and beautifully how there had been an interruption in the cultural transmission in her own family, because when her grandmother went into that school, she is a somebody who's a spiritual person. She practices the ceremony. She had the language, but for many, many years following that experience, she had a deep shame about that part of herself. She had a deep shame about who she was. And also she was more simply traumatized by the experience that she had. She'd been abused. She hadn't been the recipient of love or care. And she came out and she had her own children, as you know, the other tens of thousands of American survivors and upwards of 100,000 survivors in Canada came out, and many of them had their own children without a sense of how to love or how to parent, because they hadn't received it themselves. They hadn't received care. As Geraldine Manson, another narrator in the book, describes, nobody tucked her in at night. There were no birthdays. There was no celebration of who she was. And so the experience that Ashley's grandmother had as a parent was one of real disruption. She didn't know how to be a parent, but she, over the next couple decades of her life, started to see and started to know that the experience that she'd had in that school was part of a much larger collective experience, that this trauma had been enacted on tens of thousands of other Americans. And with that, I think there was an emboldening, not a healing, but an emboldening that happened, like, oh, this isn't my shame. This isn't my shame to carry alone. And I'm going to go back and I'm going to, you know, re-embrace that culture and that language. And I'm going to be able to share those things with my grandchildren now in a way that I couldn't with my own children, because I was still too scared. And so you see this kind of ebb and flow and the interruption of culture and language and the interruption of love within the three generations of that one family. And that's very, very typical of many, many, many Indigenous North American families. Mm-hmm. And so then you have that next generation, you know, if Ashley hadn't been so lucky to have been on the receiving end of that love and that care, then she may not have been able to, you know, come to a place of feeling so whole herself. So you see that kind of continued trauma perpetuate itself from generation to generation.
And the historical context is so incredibly important, because we know historically with African Americans, when you look at racism towards families, towards parents, the dog whistles that have come out, you know, the same thing happens with natives. If you don't have this historical context, you don't know why this is happening, mm-hmm. right? And that's so important, Suzanne.
Yes, absolutely. I've been like totally shaking my head. Yes, 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 as Sarah's been speaking. I mean, I was also looking out the window at the trees, the fir trees outside my office window, because, you know, it is a heavy legacy to carry. Mm-hmm. That lack of love, the interruption in parenting, and the deliberate, it was a policy, a deliberate policy and practice of colonial governments on both sides of the border to break apart the Indigenous family. Mm-hmm. Because when they break families apart and they you know, create interruptions in communities so that communities cannot work together effectively, then that makes it all the more easier to move us off the land. And land is wealth, and we know the rest, right? And so as I was hearing Sarah speak, I mean, yes, that love and the parenting aspect is so much a part of it. But to speak also to, you know, when Ashley's family, you know, and her grandmother had these realizations, and her mother was able to benefit from that. And then, you know, Ashley's mom was able to parent differently than her grandmother had been. I see that a lot in the community as well. And I see it as being really related to how colonization and continuing experiences of colonialism, the systemic and structural stuff, really affects Indigenous identity and agency. Because, you know, when, as Sarah said, you have that shame around who you are, and you're pathologized as a people, you know, you're told that you're not worthy and your ways of being are somehow uncivilized and you need to be, you know, doing things in the European way. You know, that creates this whole thing where people then do not learn who they are in terms of where they belong and their connection to the land. And that interrupts all of those identity things. And we all know that identity is key to developing a positive self-concept, right? And handing that down as well. And that relates directly to agency. If you're told that you're not anything, that you're nothing, and your culture is nothing, you start to believe that you deserve what happens to you. All of these negative experiences with institutional racism and systemic barriers, you start to think that it's a result of your own, you know, shortcomings, or that somehow you don't deserve to be happy or successful. And so it takes a real strength of purpose when I've spoken to survivors and considered my own family history and the work, you know, I've had to do. I think it takes a real strength of purpose to not only, you know, deal with that lack of love and the lack of parenting, and to be able to perhaps not forgive, not in every case, but to be able to say, okay, I know why my parents were the way they were, because this happened to them and it was a deliberate thing. And then to regain that sense of identity and agency so that you can place yourself within a culture, within, you know, this, the stories that you need to know, that tell you that, ah, yes, we have governance systems, we have science and medicine, we are awesome, strong, creative, resilient people. And to get all of that back and make it different for your kid and the next generation, as so many families have, it just speaks to an amazing strength that, you know, I see that in the book, in these stories so much as well.
We're going to take a quick break. That is Suzanne Methot, Curriculum Specialist for How We Go Home, Voices from Indigenous North America. Sarah Sinclair is editor of the new book, How We Go Home, Voices from Indigenous North America. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. Today we are talking about a new book, How We Go Home, Voices from Indigenous North America. It's a collection of 12 first-person stories by Indigenous people in the U.S. and Canada, and they discuss their ongoing work to protect Native land, revitalize culture and language, and advocate for missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And they tell very deep personal stories. We're joined today by Sarah Sinclair, an oral historian, writer, and educator of Cree, Ojibwe, and settler descent. Sarah is editor of the book, How We Go Home. Suzanne Methot is curriculum specialist for the book, a writer, editor, and educator of Nahio Heritage. Suzanne is also author of Legacy, Trauma, Story, and Indigenous Healing. And you can give us a call if you have any questions or comments for Sarah or Suzanne, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Sarah, can you talk about what really inspired the book? In the introduction, you write about your oral history thesis, which focused on Native North Americans after they finished their schooling and returned to their nations and reservation communities to do their work. And then it shifted a bit to really focus on the question that I mentioned in the intro, what is it like to be a citizen of one nation subsumed within a larger nation whose fundamental economic, social, political, and cultural goals are so often at odds?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was really motivated when I thought about, you know, throughout the process of working on this book, I was thinking about two audiences. I was always thinking about a mainstream audience, because as we've been speaking about, there just isn't a lot of we were speaking about how there's increasingly room being made for these stories, but that there hasn't been enough room given, that there hasn't been enough attention given. And I really wanted to be able to place the Native contemporary experience within a larger historical context. And Ashley Hemmers, whose story is in the book, and Wheezy Pan Little Elk, whose story is also included in the book, were two of the people that I had interviewed for my thesis work. When I came to the oral history master's program at Columbia, I was really interested in using oral history in particular to amplify contemporary Indigenous voices for all of the reasons that we've been speaking about. And I had such incredible experiences visiting with each of them and speaking with each of them. You know, I traveled to Fort Mojave, as I described, to meet with Ashley. I traveled to the Rosebud Indian Reservation in South Dakota to meet with Wizipan. And both of them were just brilliant educators and incredibly generous speakers. I spent basically weekends with each of them, you know, and there were times during those weekends that were sort of formal speaking and listening sessions. And then there were times that were not. There was Ashley driving me around her nation, showing me the mountain peaks. And there was Wheezypan having myself and my father, who'd come with me on that road trip, over for dinner in his backyard with his wife and his son, or, you know, popping by the morning we were leaving to watch his little boy watching the Berenstain Bears in Lakota. So I had these really, really rich encounters with each of them. And I was left each time with the feeling that I'd been given an enormous gift, because each of them was able to narrate the specific history of their own nations within the context of the larger American story. And that's what's really, I mean, that's one of the things that's really missing, right? Is that not only is there not a lot of attention given to the Native American or the First Nation story, but there's certainly not a lot of understanding about the differentiation, right? And so one of the things that I came back to New York and back to the program with was this feeling that imagine how much I could learn and imagine how much I could share if I could keep traveling across the continent and keep meeting people, you know, where they are and where their families have been. And they could speak about the particular relationship that their people have had with that specific part of the continent's land and the rich, rich history there. And also how they can share the story of how their own life and the life of their parents and the life of their grandparents and their great grandparents is connected to the larger history of this country. And it was, you know, it was really because they gave me such a great gift that I felt like, oh, I can be a conduit. I can be a conduit here to some pretty amazing stories. Because I, as a person, have always really, really loved listening and editing. And I think those are the two things that sort of make a good oral historian, at least one who wants to turn stories into books. And so I was motivated by that. I was motivated by the power of the stories that were being shared with me and by the feeling that there wasn't a lot of work like this out there and that maybe other people could be really excited too. When I thought about the Native audience, I thought in particular about a younger audience, and Voice of Witness does a lot of work with education. They work really, really hard to create these very unique curriculums, you know, each time hiring a different specialist, Suzanne being that specialist for this particular project. And then they work really hard to get these books into schools. And one story that I thought about a lot was a story that Ashley shared with me about her own experience as a young person growing up, how she became obsessed with the Holocaust at some point in her youth, because she started to read about these stories that talked about intergenerational trauma. And it was the first time that she understood that that was what she was seeing in her own community. But she had to read about the Holocaust to understand that. And so I was thinking, oh, this book could be an amazing tool for young Indigenous kids today who maybe haven't had the opportunity to learn about intergenerational trauma, this is offering that same place of reflection, but also within an Indigenous context. So I was really thinking about, you know, both of those audiences and for those reasons.
Have you spoken, I'm sure you have spoken to all of the people in your book. I just wonder what the reaction has been. I was specifically thinking about, is it Jocelyn Charger?
Jocelyn,
thank you. Jocelyn Charger, who was one of the first young people who started camping at Standing Rock right there in the very beginning. And I was really struck as a journalist reading about Jocelyn's experience when I believe it was the New York Times featured her in a piece but didn't even bother to interview her. And so I just wondered, you know, she doesn't have that much trust in the media for obvious reasons. Yeah. And I wonder what it's like for her now for her story to be in print.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it was so the experience that I had with her was, I mean, the experience that I had with all my narrators was just so, so beautiful. But yeah, what was striking about the experience with Jocelyn in particular was that she arrived at our meeting with her partner. And at the beginning of our conversation, he was hovering pretty close, which was fine. And I did understand it was because they needed to both trust me before he was going to leave, because she'd had this really poor experience with the New York Times piece where basically this reporter came, and I believe they did speak to her, but they spoke more to the people around her to kind of flesh out the story of her life. And they ended up telling a story about her family that was really hurtful to her, that she didn't feel reflected her family in the way that she would have chosen to speak about them. And so she was very hurt by that experience. And so I felt really grateful that this experience allowed her to tell her story in a different way, that she, you know, one thing that we like to think of ourselves as oral historians is that we're co-constructing anything with our narrators, right? We don't go into an interview with our own agenda. We're really there to follow the lead of the narrator. So, you know, I was very, very happy to be able to create this space for her to tell her story the way that she wanted to tell it.
And Jocelyn, like the others in the book, have gone through so much. It was pretty shocking to read about what happened to her. She told you the story about what happened when she was 13 and her aunt died of diabetes in her sleep. She said, one of our traditions is bloodletting for healing. We cut ourselves and we let the blood return to the earth. It's a way for us to get all of our bad emotions, all of our bad thoughts out. Staff at school saw my cuts, but they didn't understand them. They thought I was trying to kill myself. And so they called the Department of Social Services and got me taken away. Instead of trying to understand my tradition, she said, they instantly thought there was something wrong with me. They said I was a danger to myself and other people. And so she got taken away to Regional Health Behavioral Health Center.
Yeah, for 5 years.
That was just
for 5 years.
Incredible to read about.
Yeah, and she has a twin sister, and they were both taken away, and they were both extremely traumatized by being separated from each other above and beyond anything else.
Suzanne, can you jump in here and talk about this? Because so many youth are taken away. A lot of people in the book were also with foster families. Some foster families treated them well. For others, it was absolutely horrific experience.
Yeah. I'm glad that we're talking about this because, you know, I wasn't able just due to reasons of space. You know, I wanted to make a curriculum that was like, you know, 50 or 100 pages long and voice of witness, you know, said, well, you know, and the whole foster care and being adopted out as well features in so many of the narrator's stories. And I wasn't able to create a lesson on it, but I was able to, you know, weave the idea in and, like, you know, discussion questions about that, you know, into other lessons, you know, the identity lesson and other ones, and the college curriculum, big ideas, those sorts of things. But yeah, it's a huge thing. And when you asked Sarah about, you know, what, you know, was behind your decision in framing the book and for different audiences, I immediately started thinking about the curriculum as well. Because that was one of the first questions that, you know, we had to deal with when I first met with the Voice of Witness team, is they said, you know, how do we handle this? Do we create, you know, a set for Indigenous learners? How do we make sure that non-Indigenous learners are given enough information to understand some of the concepts? Because, you know, early on, I said, I want to use Indigenous pedagogies whenever possible, you know, or arts-based projects, land-based sort of, you know, not just reading and writing. And the thing is with the curriculum, and because of the history of foster care and adoption, is so many of us, and I include myself in that, and my own journey over the last 30 or so years, we're so much in a process now of reclaiming and relearning the cultural aspects because of that history of family separation. And because of, you know, the fact that our ceremonies and songs and dances were actually criminalized, you know, by colonial law. So when I went to put together, you know, the first kind of draft of some of the lessons, I knew I was going to have to address Indigenous students because, you know, 60 to 70% of us are urban-based now. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that that stat is quite consistent across the border in both countries. You know, and so any teacher teaching in any classroom is going to have an Indigenous student. Whether or not they've self-identified is another thing. Whether or not they're comfortable doing that, or even perhaps even know that family history. But I knew I was going to be writing curriculum that would have to address them wherever they were on their learning and cultural reclamation journey. And, you know, some families have managed to keep ceremony and the practices and the languages alive. So you're going to have some students who, you know, feel pretty confident that they know a lot of this stuff. And then you're going to have some students where they're going to go home and talk to their parents about, oh, we're looking at these stories in this book, how we go home and look, we're doing these lessons. And that's the point at which the parent is going to say, oh, well, actually, I was in boarding school and I'm going to tell you, did you know that we're, you know, of blank nation. Seriously, that's going to happen. I've seen that happen with students that I've taught. So where they discover and their parents finally open up about the history of the family. So, you know, and it wasn't too much of a struggle for me to sort of deal with that, because I think given the, you know, the reality of foster care and adoption and the cultural dislocation that has resulted, I look at the curriculum as a way to inform everyone, whether they're an Indigenous student, whether they're a non-Indigenous student, about Indigenous ways of knowing, being, and doing the true history of the Americas, and to hold them in the same regard and at the same level as European ideas, you know, and to do that work that we're all learning this, and never to put a student in a leadership position unless they request it and are ready for it. But I've also seen it happen where, you know, when teachers introduce, you know, Indigenous specific curriculum, that even if an Indigenous student knows what's being talked about and it's part of their lived experience, it's like, yeah, I sort of get that. It still feels really good for them to be in a classroom and have the topic discussed and the issue brought forward, because it feels good to be seen. Right. It feels good to be heard, right? So even if they already know it, that's fine too, right? Mm-hmm. So true. Yeah. Yeah.
We're almost out of time. We have a lot of educators listening to this show. What can they do to incorporate this book and the work that you're doing into their curriculum?
Well, first of all is, you know, we have a preface for educators in the curriculum, you know, booklet or publication, whatever you want to call it. And I want educators to know that it's okay to be a little freaked out. It's okay to be unsure. It's okay to say, you know, I don't know if I know enough about this to teach this stuff, because that's the reality, that we were not taught taught about this in school, as Sarah said early on, you know. So I've done the lessons, and I have this preface for educators that talks about a few things they can do to prepare to teach these lessons, you know, and it's simple and not so simple stuff about, well, read the appendices and How We Go Home, which are essays on, you know, the true history and some of the things you need to know to increase your critical consciousness, right? Mm-hmm. Review, you know, school and community resources, you know, and just cultivate a deeper understanding of the aims and effects of colonialism. And be comfortable with saying, especially when you get a question from a student, be comfortable saying, you know what? I don't know, but how can we find that out?
Right.
Right. And so really giving teachers, educators, you know, the feeling that they're supported in taking this curriculum and starting with one lesson or even a part of one lesson, one conversation, one, you know, a piece of something, or doing the whole thing back to back. Because I think we have, what is it, 6 or 8 lessons in here? I've already, the numbers, not even, I can't even remember that anymore. But, you know, so whether you start little or you start big, you know, I wanted them to feel supported. We've given them information. And, you know, we have some real, you know, concrete tools here as well. And a lot of different, you know, online resources around how to deal with your own as an educator and students' reactions when they are emotional reactions to the material. Some of this can be hard. How to create safe spaces, you know, what does it mean to develop a decolonized pedagogy? There are Indigenous scholars like Marie Batiste and Linda Smith who are doing this work. You know, here's some, you know, we've given them links to some videos and really supporting them and knowing that, and I'm going to end with this saying that knowing that it's okay to make mistakes too, because as an educator and a former classroom teacher myself, you know, sometimes we have a lot invested in that role of expert, right? So to just step back from that and be okay with saying, okay, we've learned something here, and understanding that next year you can do it a little differently, right?
Well, the hour went by so fast. I want to thank both of you for joining us. We would love to have you back because we barely scratched the surface of some of these stories, really incredible stories. Suzanne Methot is curriculum specialist for How We Go Home, Voices from Indigenous North America, and Sarah Sinclair is editor of this incredible new book. Thank you both for all of your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.